My name is Rick Gray, and
and you're an addict.
Nah. I stopped being an addict when I got saved, and then I got addicted to that, and then I got saved from that, and now I'm okay again. All right? So that's a whole different story. But my background is in psychology. I have a master's degree in sociology, a PhD in psychology. The psychology degree was in Jungian theory. And in the process of obtaining that degree, they said, you've got to learn something separate, something different. And I said, here's my excuse to study NLP. And so I got practitioner, master practitioner, back while I was doing my PhD. About that time, when I finished my degree, I was working as a federal probation officer. And at that point, I had an automation assignment. I was the computer geek, still being paid for law enforcement work. And they said if I didn't go back to law enforcement work, I would lose my pension, and federal pensions are really nice to have. So they put me in a drug treatment caseload. And I did rejoice, okay, because I had these tools. Like NLP, I could do hypnosis, core transformations, all kinds of stuff. And we then decided that the programs that we had, for which we were paying on an average $16,000 per person for 9 weeks of intensive treatment, were a big waste of money. We decided to build a program. And the program we built was the Brooklyn program. And we ended up, for 2 hours of my time every week, doing several hundred clients, and we ended up among people with verified previous drug abuse, people whose urines we had tested, roughly 30%, 29%, 0.6% clean a year after they did the program. And people have reported back to me that most of those people remained sober afterwards. So we had very good results. And I like to tell people that for about 7 years, for more like 9 years, I had essentially my own hypnosis lab, working for the government, not needing a license in New York. I could do just about anything I pleased to anybody. And it was all nice. It was all nice, and it was all pleasant, and all in their good interests. So that was very, very nice. Well, over the past, one of the things that happened to me in 1999, they sent me to a training that I had no intention of going, but they had set it up, and it was only 2 miles from my home, so I went. And one of the things they'd signed me up for was the National Institutes of Drug Abuse had a representative there, and they were presenting the newest cutting-edge information about the midbrain dopamine system and how that impacted drugs and drug addiction. And I understood from that I didn't need to convince anybody about anything for my program. All I had to do was give them experiences. And that was the genesis of the program as it finally developed. But since that point, I became kind of a neuroscience junkie. I am not a neuroscientist. I do not play one on TV. But I love the stuff. And it's very masochistic. You know, I have to read the same article 5 or 10 times before it finally gets in there. But eventually I get something useful. And the interesting thing about all of this stuff is that always, always, always they're looking to derive some pharmaceutical cure for what they're doing. In the meantime, they're telling you, here are all these behavioral consequences. This part awakens when you do this, and this part awakens when you do that. And if you do this, that part... I said, my God, can't you see that a little NLP or even some good psychology, you can turn this stuff into very inexpensive, very practical ways of dealing with human behavior. So that's been kind of my hobby for the last, I don't know how many years, almost 15 years. And one of the other things that happened, this is just as brief an introduction as I can give you. We got involved with Frank Burke and the NLP R&R project, and we wanted to begin researching the fast phobia cure for work with PTSD. And Rich and I worked on trying to find a mechanism for that actually explained the results we get. And most psychological information talks about extinction, and it wasn't extinction. Extinction sets up a new memory that says something else is happening here, but it doesn't change the memory. We change the memory, we change it permanently. And we came upon the phenomenon of reconsolidation, the idea that when you awaken a memory under certain circumstances, the proteins that originally cooked that memory into long-term status okay, are produced again, and that memory becomes susceptible to change. Whoa! Okay? Here's a mechanism that says precisely what we do. You turn on the memory, you stop it before it gets bad, before it takes over the entire system. But because you've started it, those chemicals start cooking. And they are the AMPAs and the other long-term memory-associated proteins. But they're cooking. And you could put something new in there. Like, for instance, doing the trauma on purpose. Okay? For instance, running it in black and white so it's dissociated. For instance, running it backwards, fully associated. And what happens? Because you've layered in these new levels of understanding and experience, it's no longer connected to the trauma. You can remember the trauma, you can talk about it, you can say what happened, but it just doesn't feel the same. You've abstracted out the memory, and it's permanent. And the characteristic of the things that we do over and over again is that we make changes, we make relatively quick changes, and the changes are permanent. And so that says that one of the things that we deal with is the reconsolidation. I'm also dyslexic from time to time. It appears miraculously just when I need a way to stop thinking in the middle of what I'm thinking about. Okay, so we have reconsolidation. And I explained last year about how that works for the PTSD cure. We talked a little bit last time, but I want to go over that again because this is really important. And I think I've understood it more effectively. When we do a pattern interrupt, what are we doing? We evoke the experience. We stop it either before it takes over the entire system or when it's begun to take over the system and we catch it. And then what do? Half the time, we do something irrelevant. And we lose the power of it, but we get a nice trance out of it. Then you go do something else. Well, that's the next part of what we're going to be talking about. But in order to take full advantage of that, if we intentionally put something related into that space, that will become part of the memory. And I've got two great examples from Nick Kemp. And I talked about these last year, but I want to talk about them again. Nick Kemp has this absurd approach to interventions. Okay? Oh, man, I hate my brother. I hate my sister. My world's coming to an end. Have you tried walking naked down the street playing the guitar? What? Well, have you considered maybe picking your nose with peanut butter-covered fingers? What? Now, what happens? Suddenly people step back, they think about something else that might be a reasonable approach, and they walk out and they never go back and do that again. What happens? Well, reconsolidation loves ambiguity, novelty. It responds especially well when what you expect doesn't happen. If you think about verbal patterns, sleight of mouth patterns, what happens? You open up a chain of behavior and suddenly it goes in a different direction. That takes advantage of the same kind of phenomenon. But crucially, there has to be novelty. And the other piece is that it has to be related to the thing you're working with. You get something else like trans-derivational search if it's not related to it. And so here's Nick. He plugs in this absolutely absurd result, and people walk out happy and healed, and it doesn't come back. Second example from Nick is the kitchen sink phenomenon. You all know what your kitchen sinking is? All right, somebody begins to complain about you, and instead of just the thing they're concerned about, this emotional rush comes out of them, and it connects every possible thing that you may have ever done in your entire life, why the world is wrong, and why it's your fault, and it goes out in this flow of logorrhea that just can't seem to stop, all powered by anger. And so what's Nick do? The thing starts? He said, wait a minute. I need you to help me a little bit. I'm really concerned about what's going on here. Could you just stop one at a time? Because I really want to get this. And tell me about one problem at a time so we can solve them. Reconsolidation. What happens? You've interrupted the response. The chemicals are still cooking. The proteins are still getting ready to reinforce that old pattern. But you slid something else, something new in there. The capacity to take control, the capacity to focus specifically not on the emotional content, but on the behavior that is of concern at the moment. The associative chain that is driven by affect is broken, and suddenly they are reasonably discussing that one problem and can't get back to the flow of behavior. Now, this happens over and over and over again. And I think one of the important lessons that we as Nelpers, however you say that, can take from that, okay, is that if you have that kind of behavior, stop it and think about what you're going to put there. Because we often don't. We think that pattern interrupts are not. So we get sometimes uneven responses to pattern interrupts, don't we? Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't work. I would suggest that the key is that either the thing that you are putting into that slot isn't related to the original memory or the original problem. You haven't made it relate, like Nick's. Well, I know how to solve that. Go stand on your head in the middle of the street. Okay? What makes it relate? I know how to solve that. And so they've opened up, and that becomes an addition that slots into that space and does it. Now, this doesn't sound a lot like, yeah.
This is really important, but I'm still not getting it. What? How does it relate? By saying I know how to solve that?
That's one way. Yeah, that's one way. And sometimes just the context. But in terms of the meaning structure, you have to make it relate somehow. So let's go back. The very simplest example I can think of is the fast phobia cure. Okay? We're going to deal with this phenomenon. Okay? So what do? We evoke it, and we stop it. Now, everything we do from then on is related specifically to the phobia. Imagine yourself in a movie watching it in black and white. Oh, that has to do with a movie. But now I'm re-experiencing it in a completely disassociated way. Okay? That will be incorporated into the structure of the memory. Then we run it backwards in fully associated, full color, full multisensory mode. It's obviously related because it is that phenomenon itself. Okay? And so they will be incorporated into that problem. Go through Nick's example again. Think about kitchen sinking. He stops it. And he says, I'm really concerned about answering your objections, your problems. Okay? And so that relates it. Okay? Now, there are sometimes memory structures. What I was going to say is that this is based on real heavy-duty neuroscientific evidence that really looks at protein synthesis and learning protocols. All right? So they've tested this surprisingly, from organisms from a plesia, the sea squirt, up through various invertebrates, through all kinds of animals, and they're just beginning to apply it to humans. We've been doing it for 35 years, which is very striking. And one of the things that validates NLP in a striking way is because we are an empirical discipline, it's very important for you to realize that there is science out there backing up everything that we do, because we only do what gets results, and if it doesn't get results, it goes by the wayside. Sometimes our explanations are for Costa, but the reality is we get the results because we care about process and we care about results. And if you go out there and take the time, there is a set of scientific data that supports what we do. Okay, so that's a little bit on that. Let me see, I have a couple of other examples. VKD, pattern interrupt with relevance segue. Nick kept Kim to kitchen sink. Olivia Roberts. Okay, I don't know how many of you heard Olivia the other day, but she has a protocol. I don't know about this. Very straight. Okay. She has a protocol.
You're just wired.
That's right. I'm just too much caffeine. Ah. Oh, well. But anyway. Or maybe not enough. I need that paradoxical effect, you know, ADDHD. It just slowing me down. Okay. But in any event, Olivia Roberts has this technique. And whether it's a symptom or a psychological problem, a physical symptom or a psychological problem, okay, it comes up and you say, go away, go away, go away. And then you move back to a time when you experience a positive affect. And you do that a couple times, and over time, the thing just goes away after you get in the habit of saying, go away, go away, go away. Well, that doesn't sound particularly scientific, but what are we doing here? We're going from a passive, suffering, right orbital frontal cortex, take me away from this kind of mentality where you're a victim, to a left orbital frontal cortex, positively valenced, intense, angry state that opens you up for programming positive things. Ooh, isn't that interesting? Anger opens people up for positive affect. Yeah.
Years ago, we had the Northridge earthquake in Southern California, yeah. And I went down there the next day to do a training. And it was on negotiation, but every once in a while we get a tremor aftershock and the dust would come out of the ceiling and everybody start panicking. And I saw a really cool thing. So I ended up not doing the negotiation. I was doing more of the fast phobia process. But the fire marshal in L.A. had a great process. He was on TV and he said, look, if we start getting a bad aftershock, I want you to do this. Get on the ground and go, stop it, stop it, stop it.
Excellent.
I told the group about that. And it started shaking and everybody went, stop it, stop it. The reason everybody was laughing. Exactly that same phenomenon.
Yeah. That's it. And never again would they respond quite the same. You know, they might do something rational, but it would never be quite the same. So here's a really important thing. Now, since 2 years ago, one of the things that I've found in the research is that absurd responses are some of the best ways to stimulate those neurons into cooking up new versions of the memory. Okay, they've come to the conclusion now that reconsolidation is the brain's way of keeping memories relevant. Okay, if you get upset and you get more upset and you just keep getting upset, well, that gets stronger and it maintains itself. But if you get upset and somebody stops the upset and empowers you to do something, or you take the initiative to take responsibility, as you guys were talking about this morning, and do something different, that gets wired into that memory structure. Okay, so that's very important. Novelty is a crucial piece. And I think almost everything, except for the last piece we'll be talking about today, novelty is something that the brain sorts for. Okay, we always talk about the difference that makes a difference. Okay, but when you look at the research, they will talk to you about mismatches in reinforcement expectancies, and whatever the world that means. That means you expect something to come one way, and it comes to you another way. Your brain lights up and says, tell me more. And if it's about a problem behavior, that new information gets slotted into the new behavior. Okay? So that's really important. It's important, however, to remember that if you're going to do the pattern interrupt, if you're doing the fast phobia cure as a trauma intervention or anything else like that, that you must not allow the person to become fully traumatized. There is a window. And the window requires that you stop the response before it becomes a full-blown panic or traumatic response. Otherwise, you've just reinforced it and re-traumatized your patient. Okay? So that's a very crucial ecological consideration, but it's also a crucial criterion for getting this phenomenon to work. Okay? So those are just some examples. And I'm sure that you guys can think of some examples for yourselves where you stop something and do it. Now, this works with emotional memories precisely this way. If you're working with semantic memories, memories about words or about content or experiences that are not specifically emotionally, you may have to tell people to add it in. Okay? If people are trying to learn a new song or something, they say, add this in. And they will. Otherwise, it gets jumbled. With physical responses, like training, What the research seems to say is people just get confused and they don't do it as well as they used to. So be careful about where you use this. This works for emotional memories, in particular, this way. Okay? There isn't a lot of fully developed research about how to apply it to physical memories of process, and it's growing in semantic memories, but much less than we'd like to think. Okay? Any questions about that? I'm sure there are lots, but let them percolate through your brain. Slot some new stuff in there, and you'll be surprised. Okay, so that's one thing. Now, one of the things that this implies is that there is a well-formedness syntax for emotional change. Okay? And this is what the basic neuroscientists and behavioral scientists have been pulling out, but they have no idea that's what it is. And that's evoke the response, stop it, okay? Provide what they call an amnestic stimulus, okay? An amnestic stimulus, something that potentially could wipe out the entire memory or modify it significantly, okay? And then test. Okay? And so we find that in things like, well, the allergy cure. Okay? You evoke the problem, insert something neutral, okay? Add the matching state, and test it. If you think about collapsing anchors, okay? You have the negative anchor. Very often you put in a neutral anchor. Add the positive anchor, collapse them. So here's something very similar. So here's a phenomenon that seems to apply to an awful lot of what we do in NLP. It's called reconciliation. You'll see more of it coming up over and over again. But it's a very, very powerful metaphor to explain what's going on. Steve Andrews says, please don't do that. Don't talk about reconciliation. But I think we need to be able to connect this back up with science. One of the things that's important to us, especially in the R&R group, is to make sure that we have plausible explanations for why we do what we do and why it works. One of the critiques, Rich and I and Frank, Lisa Wake from over in the UK and a bunch of other people were involved in writing a book on the scientific correlates, let's say, of NLP, and it'll be published by Routledge in November. And One of the complaints over the years about NLP is we promise this stuff like magic, and the magic never happens. Well, baloney. The magic often happens, but because we don't have explanations, because we haven't tied it to science in many ways, okay, people think that we're invoking devils or who knows what. But the reality is that all of this is science-based, and we need to make sure that we've made those associations. So I'd like to think when the handouts, when you get them, if you get them, they have a chart that talks about this as a well-formedness condition for emotional change. And I think it's a very important way to think about this. Okay, so this comes straight out of behavioral studies. There have been hundreds of studies. It always helps to plug in the plug, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
It hurts here. And my mommy didn't love me. Oh, no. The next thing I want to talk to you about is the way behaviors are organized. And they're organized in terms of what's called small world networks. Okay, now this is networking theory, and it applies to the way the brain organizes information. This is not neurophysiology per se, but it is about how the brain makes use of the neurophysiology that we have. The major pathways that we have tend to connect one kind of a cell to a similar kind of cell. Okay, we talk about synaptic connections, Hebbian law, things that fire together, wire together, and we talk about neurogenesis and the deep parts of the dentate gyrus and all those other wonderful places, whatever that means, I have no idea. Okay, but what's important here is to realize that the brain sets up roots and patterns of behavior and activity that are largely separate from one another and become our go-to behavioral chains. The schemata, ooh, nice fancy word, the patterns that we go to habitually very often insulate us completely from other possibilities. A drug addict awfulizes sober life because the pathway that they have become accustomed to only connects drug dealers, drug-related phenomena, drug-related food, munchies, Cheech and Chong movies, with everything else that they do, okay? That's all there is in the world. And if it isn't drug-related, it goes away. A couple of interesting things. In Vietnam, 43% of the GIs there were addicted to heroin. They get pure heroin every day, walk out, buy it, stick it up their arm, up their nose, and just, the war went away. And very striking. More than 6 months, it meets the diagnostic criteria for addiction. They urine tested a bunch of them before they left Vietnam. And they prepared for this massive influx of addicts. Well, they got home. And the addiction rate dropped to 5%. Of those 46%. What happened? They had set up a set of pathways, a set of neural linkages, a set of habits, okay, that can be interrupted, by the way, okay, speaking of pattern interrupts, that fit that context, that context evoked for them reliably, that served their needs. The positive intent, it freed them from a context of an unthankful war that they didn't want to sign up for, but it was better than college. And beyond that, okay, it gave them some sense of relief from the ongoing and continuous stress. They come back home, and what happens? 5%. Only 5% remain addicted. 95% remission rate. And that's why they say, we'd say cure. They say, remission it. You're always an addict. That drug is evil. That drug is subtle. Okay, it'll come. Bill W. is a wonderful guy, but I think he was right. We should have given him all LSD. But that's another story. What happened? There were circuits at home. There were pathways and patterns of habit. There were reinforcement possibilities. There were lovers and wives and husbands and mates and jobs and possibilities and well-formed outcomes that were ready for them to walk into that had nothing to do with jobs. The circuit switch, and suddenly drugs were no longer part of their life. And here's a phenomenon that happens another place where that shows up with drugs. Is a famous study by Alexander et al. Again, this is, I think, from the 70s. The rat park study. Same kind of thing. Put rats in cages. Feed them morphine water until they get the jimmies, if they can't get it. Okay, the jim jams, I guess. And put them in a rat park. Okay, where they have rat buddies, rat girlfriends, rat places to hide and play, chips to eat and throw in the air. Okay, lots of rat things to do. What happens to the morphine water? Every once in a while they might take a taste, but for the most part they would much rather have plain water. And the addiction goes away completely. What's happened? On an instinctual, we ethologists wouldn't approve of the word instinctual, but in common parlance, the instinctual programs that make for meaningful ratitude, okay? The self-actualization of a rat, all right, is about being able to do the things that are meaningful to a rat. Having rat sex and rat buddies and eating rat chow and running around the perimeters of the rat garden and having a good rat time. And drugs just get in the way of that. Okay, so that's an important piece to consider. Yeah, ratitude. Rat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat. I've jumped ahead of myself, but that's okay. So here's another thing to consider, the circuits. You guys this morning were talking about circuits. The Hall bombs. Finally spell it right. I'll learn to say it right one of these days, too. For years I was citing the H-A-L-B-O-M. And when I got this email, it's Hall Bomb. I said, yes, I'm sorry, don't hit me. Okay. But one of the things that Tim spoke about this morning, or Chris did, I don't remember which one of you was when she was healing, you know, and I was doing the same thing this spring. I was sitting around in my long dashiki thing with, my nightshirt, and just hanging out. Gotta get dressed. My mother used to say, if you look well, you will feel well. And she took another drink, but that's another story. And but the reality is, putting on the clothes that say, I am well, I am prepared, I am ready to go, okay, invoke that circuit. That circuit that says, I am normal, I am growing, life is good, okay? And all of the circuits that support normal livelihood, normal healing, normal strength, normal attitude, positive attitude, are more likely to emerge. And we go back to AA and NA, and they say, fake it till you make it. And we have acting as if. And the power of that is that it invokes circuits. The circuits of habits that bring into salience the kinds of behaviors we want. Okay? Practice makes perfect. Even if it's faith, practice makes perfect. Act as if. Okay? It evokes those pathways. And so one of the questions that we want to think about is that how many ways are there to evoke whole behavioral change? Yes, you have a question?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I see people twitch, and I, you know, make believe I'm psychic. And all right, it makes my students crazy. So when somebody starts to scratch, yes, can I help them? And they say, they say, Gray is watching. Be careful. You know, they start to fall asleep, and they say, and as you drift gently off, and everybody goes and stares at them. So if I'm sorry. Oh, a question, yes.
Can I get up and get a glass of water?
Oh, please do. I dry me out. I imagine it must have the same kind of effect on you. Drink water, sister. Live long and prosper. Oh, no, wait. Oh, excuse me. Let me move back over to this other mind map where this stuff is. Because, let's think about some circuits. How do these circuits work? Mary Lou Henner just came out with a book on how to build your memory for experiences that you've had. Are you aware of that? I love memory stuff. Dame Edith Yates and her book on mnemotechnics, classic. And I don't know if you ever work with people with memory needs, but one of the things that Mary Lou Henner says is that, and she is one of the people in the world who has the capacity to remember everything she has ever done. And she sat down, and literally, it is you tell her a date, and she can tell you exactly what she did, who she did it with, what she ate, what she didn't eat, you know, everything. What was on the newspaper, what was on the news, okay, and why you shouldn't care. She also has written this book that purports to tell you how to do it. And so she does this, and maybe you can do it with me. Think of a memory that you haven't thought about in a while that you would like to remember more of, okay, or more clearly. I teach writing, and so I'm conscious of my misspeakings. Think of a memory. Well, you can all think of a pleasant memory that you'd like to remember more vividly. And as NLPers, you all know that you can make it bigger and brighter and closer, right? And you can turn on the sound and notice whether the sound moves with the picture, and if it doesn't, you can make it do so. That fires up the superior click list, and it goes, oh, this is worth paying attention to. Okay, but as you do that, you already know that memory has become more vivid, sharper. You can look down at your shoes and see what kind of shoes you were wearing, okay? You can remember who was there, what they were saying, and why you hate them. Okay? You can remember all kinds of things. The minor details begin to come up as you deal with that memory. Well, that's the first step in her process. Think of a memory that you'd like to remember. Now go through that memory and begin to think. Begin to take a look at, well, what was the neighborhood? What time of year was it? Was there music playing? And if there was music playing, can you remember what that was? Are there smells associated with that memory? And that's always the kicker, you know. You go for smells, and they go, wow, yeah, here we go. Okay. And as you do that, that memory grows sharper and sharper. Now, I always take it to the point where we want to focus on the feelings and drive out the content and just go float out into the stratosphere. But on a very practical level, if we use that to re-evoke a memory and to strengthen a memory, well, there are other memory chains. Here we are back to those circuits that are associated with the various parts of those memories. And so once you've enhanced that memory, you can focus on some person or some other facet of that memory that has links to other memories that you may have never thought of, especially emotional links. Focus on the emotion, and it'll draw you to other memories. You all know that. I don't have to tell you that. But this is part of the way the brain's circuitry works. And so if you focus on a set of memories, your whole capacity for remembering begins to spread out. As you systematically go through some of those details, a whole pattern of times and events around that original memory become more and more available. Now, if we do that with resources, one of the striking things that we all should know and be making use of, oh, look, I dropped that on the floor and I'm going to kill myself. And everybody in the room is going to talk, when we begin with a resource state, one of the nice things about memories is that they are linked by affect. Not so much by contact, but by the way we feel in them. And as we begin to call up one resource state and we magnify it using standard submodality techniques, as I said, bigger, brighter, closer, all that stuff, what happens? The felt sense of that memory evokes another like it, and it evokes another. And before long, we've evoked not just those discrete memories, but the possibility of revivifying a whole life pathway that gives people another set of options about the way they are going to respond in the present. And the more we can encourage them to just enjoy those resources, the more likely they are to switch horses, as it were, in midstream. Now, we all do this all the time. You all have had favorite restaurants, and suddenly, you don't go there anymore. You'll have a way to get to work. I go the same way every day, unconsciously. I get in my car, and an hour and a half later, I'm at Fairleigh. Okay. But you know what? If you found a new way, and it were more efficient, and you began to consciously do that, that new circuit would quickly develop, and you would almost completely forget about the other one. We do that with circles of friends and associates. We do that with reading styles. All of our life tends to be arranged in these patterns of stimulus, association, connections that are relatively hardwired. They aren't really hardwired, but they are so well used that they become discrete, preferred pathways. And so we can use things like evoking resources, evoking just memories of previous times. As you think about the Vietnam vets that came back and lost their addictions, that's precisely what happened to them. A whole new world arose in their mind. It's almost like a Philip K. Dick scenario with an alternate universe standing right next to you. You take one step to the side, the world changes, and everything is new. That's one possibility for change that we always do implicitly, but this is something that the scientists, I think, are really coming to understand in terms of the organization, not of the brain wiring itself, but of the patterns of behavior that are evoked through that wiring. So that's another piece that I wanted to talk about. Not quite as soon as I did, but I easily get lost. John Walter is one of the founding lights in brief therapy, right? Solution-focused brief therapy, are you all aware of that? Mm-hmm. It's really an offshoot of NLP, but they lie about it. And But John Walter describes the case of a man with a gambling addiction. He wasn't terribly bright, took the subway to work every day, and outside the subway entrance was an OTB parlor. Mm-hmm. And he got in the habit of going there and spending his money. After a while, he was spending his entire paycheck and the rent money and everything else. The guy was in an intractable addiction. Nothing he could do about it. Nobody could convince him to change. John suggests to him, I think it would be all right if he went to work a different way. Yeah, I guess so. Takes a different way to work. Never gambles again. He's got a different pathway, a different circuit, a different way of organizing his world, and that phenomenon never reappears. Now, we have to acknowledge that just like learning to ride a bicycle when you were a kid, all right, if you get back on the bicycle, well, that could come right back. But because you've established a new set of priorities, the odds are good as long as they continue to be reinforcing, as long as they continue to be good and fulfilling, as long as they evoke curiosity and wonder on some level, as long as they are pathways and not outcomes in themselves, everybody wins. And that's one of the things about change work that I think is very important. I think it comes more from our side than the side of science, is that when we create outcomes, it's very important that those outcomes are pathways to self-realization, pathways to new depths of relationship, pathways to new possibilities every day, so that novelty is always an important part of it. If I know that my job is going to continue to challenge me every day, I'll do it. Recent study showed that pure Skinnerian reinforcement, you know, you do something, I pop an M&M in your mouth, you do it again, I pop another M&M in your mouth, I like M&Ms. Okay? That works really well for physical activity. If I want you to do something physically and I reinforce you in classical behavioral model, you will do as I say. Okay? I'll be able to shape your behavior, no problem whatsoever. But when it comes to creativity, when it comes to abstract work, that doesn't work. If somebody hates what they're doing, you could crank up their pay till the cows come home, and it's not going to change their efficiency or their ability to produce. But if you let them do it because it feels good, if you let them do it because it allows them to explore, to discover new things, and to find out how far they can push themselves in new ways, well, they'll keep doing it until they die, okay? And so here's another way that outcomes can be re-understood. All right? How much creativity, how much power for personal exploration and discovery have you built into this program? Classical psychotherapy in relationships is often about repair. How do we fix this marriage? These people still love each other, and how do we make it work? Well, you know what? You can fix it. You can patch it together. You can make it work for them on the same level that it's always worked. Like Susie Smith talking about how her life continues and it's getting stale. It's time to move again, right? But what happens if that becomes an ongoing challenge in a positive way? A way where you're continually rediscovering each other, continually awakening to new possibilities, new adventures together. You guys, somebody said they was kissing out on the dance floor. Yeah. But you know what? Don't turn red, Tim. But you know what? Is that as relationships grow, as people build a life together, as people grow together in their own separate pathways, there's always something new to explore when people are treated as individuals, okay? When people sit down to do a job, when they begin to work at something, if that job is auto-tealing, there's your $5 word of the day, auto-tealing, okay? Self-reinforcing. You do it for its own sake. You don't have to worry about that employee or anybody else. So that's your water. This is my water. I won't contaminate yours. Skull. Yar, skull. Yeah. So that's important.
Richard.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you ever read the book The Power of Habit?
Nope. Who's it by?
Charles Duhigg.
Pardon?
Charles Duhigg.
Charles Duhigg.
I can send a PowerPoint that summarizes it.
Oh, thank you. I'd appreciate that. Yeah. But tell me.
I didn't read the whole book, but I read the first book.
Well, I don't want to hear it. I read the back cover.
The first time I read this. And it started talking about, you know, the whole, the patterns in the mind and the neurological
called Firing, and it's all based off of neuroscience. And what they said was they were tracking some people who had like the serious addictions, and now they've changed. And they said that the same areas in the brain that were lighting up for the addictions were lighting up, but instead for her goals.
Yes.
So what's confusing to me, well, I guess here's my question. What's confusing to me is like what you're saying with is that this is one network and this is another, and that you're switching them, and that it's easy to go back to the old one, but wouldn't you say a fully integrated approach is to make sure that one network runs into the other? So that
no.
would never...
Let me just tell you why. Because the networks that we're talking about are technically called small world networks.
Sure.
And that the behavioral strains usually connect one hub with many others. And so the drugs, as they become the most important thing in your life, all of the connections in your life come back to drugs. And that set of patterns and associations remains whether you're using drugs or not. So that if you try to bring the new network back into serious contact with the drug network, there's some probability that because of the power of that small world organization, that the drugs will reassert themselves. The best bet is to set up that new network. Okay?
So
now, after that's established as a long-term set of habits, after that is your most preferred way of being in the world, there may be no problem in associating them. But while you are creating this new set of behaviors, it is best to stay as far away as possible. Now, in NLP, we like to go test things. Okay? And that's perfectly reasonable. If we've eliminated compulsion and somebody is no longer interested, it's fine to test it, but don't overtest it. I've told several people here about my friend who styled himself a prophet. I used to be a raging fundamentalist. Okay? A lot of people don't believe that. A lot of people can really see it. 2 years ago, they said
raging
I was
sure.
preaching. What?
Raging for sure.
Raging for sure. But there are all kinds of ways to rage, but we won't get into that. One day, God, he had gingivitis, terrible, terrible gingivitis. And one day, God spoke to the prophet, and he said, "You will never lose your teeth." And he said, "Boy, that's great." And every day after that, just to prove God true, he went into the mirror and wiggled his teeth. And every day, he wiggled them a little more, and he pulled every tooth out of his head as he tested God's promise that he would never lose his teeth. And in truth, he never did lose his teeth. He pulled them out with his own fingers. And we all have a tendency to do that. Okay? We want to test and make sure that our interventions have worked. But, all right, we want to be careful about how far we take that, because there's a level to which human curiosity will push it. I teach a course. It's really an NLP course. It's called Interviewing and Counseling Techniques for Criminal Justice Professionals. And I teach them the poor, and I teach them meta-model, and I teach them anchoring, and I teach them all kinds of weird things, how to levitate and eat chickens and the rest of it. And one of the first things I do is I have them access a resource state, crank it up so it's content-free, and just have them experience what they can do in their own heads. You know, and I tell them, think of a memory. Got that? Okay. Now imagine you can step into that memory. Oh, okay, they can do that. And if it flashes, I tell them what to do. I say, make it bigger. Did you know they could do that? No, I didn't know I could do that. Make it brighter, you know, turn on the sound, turn, you know. And all these things, they're just doing for themselves and doing it in a straight instructional tone. No Ericksonian stuff whatsoever. And they do it. I had a guy 2 weeks ago. He said, you know, that was an amazing state. I tried for the longest time to feel bad afterwards because I just didn't really believe it. And, you know, give me a break, would you? So you get people who are going to respond that way, whether it's drugs or anything else. And so after you test it, bring them back and start them on the new pathway. Start them doing new things. And when that is installed as the preferred pathway, then maybe they can dip and dab and look back. There's good research from the Rand Corporation from several years ago that recovered alcoholics, excuse the expression, most of them can go back to social drinking with no problem. But I think the issue is the time frame when they do that. Okay? The longer the time is, the better off. Yeah.
So if you're stopping them, right, and you're interrupting the pattern, and you're right, slotting it in with some kind of
meeting. Right. We're talking about a different pattern right now. We're talking about a different pattern. We're talking about associative patterns that exist as preferred pathways.
Okay.
Okay. We're not talking about reconsolidation anymore.
Okay.
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 You got that?
You've reconsolidated that.
Thank you. Okay. Does anybody else have that problem? You think I'm still talking about reconsolidation? How many people think I'm just nuts? Oh God! We're in good shape. Okay. So hey, so we have that. And if you think about the art of memory, Kabbalistic tree of life as a series of loci into which you can store information, these are again instances of pathways. Let me come back to consolidation and reconsolidation. R.G.M. Morris is one of the great psychologists of the time. And for those of you that like to torture rats, he's the guy that invented the Morris water maze. Okay, you have milky water with little stands just under the surface where the rat can't find it. Okay, and you throw the poor rat in the water, and he has to swim around until he finds the little table where he can stand and take a breath. Okay, and you take him out, and you throw him in again, and see how long it takes him to find it. And, you know, this is used for all kinds of learning. Well, Morris was testing rats. And he said to himself, he said, you know, it's important to realize that there has to be a mechanism that records everything that we do and say, everything that we experience. And then there has to be a mechanism on top of that that sorts for what's important and needs to be remembered and what needs to be forgotten. Otherwise, we would run out of memory. And that's another reason the reconsolidation mechanism, is that if we didn't have a way to reconfigure our memories, we would run out of space. We would be like Luria's Nemanist. You know the mind of a Nemanist by A.R. Luria? A great story of this person who remembered absolutely everything and couldn't forget. Couldn't forget anything. And what they found, this guy couldn't abstract, he couldn't generalize, he couldn't even keep a job because he was so full of this irrelevant information that it was no good. And so we have to have ways of updating things, deciding what's worth remembering and what's not remembering. Well, Morris decided to have this experiment. And the experiment was he would take some rats and he would, in front of a distinctive stimulus, give them something to eat with a distinctive flavor. Peanut butter rat chow, chocolate rat chow, you know, whole wheat rat chow, you know, dog food rat chow, whatever it was, all the possibilities. He said he had 150 different flavors. Sounds like an ad, doesn't it? Well, in any event, he would give them one taste in front of a stimulus, and then he would put the stimulus the next day out in a field next to a digging well where the rat could dig around. The rat had no reason to believe that there was any association. And about 50% of the time, the rats would go right to the well, dig up the food, and eat it. And they'd be very happy little rats. The next day, he would change the food, the taste, and he would change the stimulus. They're no longer doing the kind of stuff we normally do to rats. Normally, we would give them the same thing and see how quickly they learn it. He says, let's see what happens with something new. Puts the rats down in the maze. It's a straight line maze. New flavor, new stimulus, takes them out, puts the stimulus down the road, and a little more quickly, they discover where they're going to dig and eat. So he does this for a while to different groups of rats, and he discovers that rats can very quickly learn in one shot, okay, that there's going to be food associated with a stimulus. 50, 70% first couple times. But after doing it for a while, he finds that he doesn't even have to prime the rat with a new flavor. He can just put a new stimulus out there in the field, and they will know immediately to go there. So what, Gray? What are you talking about? Well, what he realizes here is having built a pathway, having built a network of learning, having built a schema for learning. Once that pattern is established, you can take information and plug it in, and it very quickly becomes part of that new network. And the stronger that network is, the more powerfully and the more quickly the new information is engaged. And so you and I can walk into an NLP conference, hear something new, the first time, 10 seconds, walk out and remember it. Why? We have a pre-existing structure into which that information can be integrated. And because it can be integrated, we don't have to practice for 30 days to get it to consolidate into long-term memory. The proteins that structure that long-term memory, when that long-term memory schema, when that pattern is evoked, well, the proteins, the reconsolidation proteins, remember them? They begin to fire off too. And that new memory takes advantage of the reconsolidation mechanism, but not to change the original memory, but to plug it into the structure of the memory. Wowie zowie. That has some really interesting implications. Okay? When we plug in alternative behaviors, okay, you evoke a pattern of behavior. I say, have you ever considered, and it slots right in. Not needing a pattern interrupt, because it may not even be a real problematic behavior, but maybe just a stuck state. But we have a pre-existing pattern of behaviors, and when it's evoked, it's susceptible to updating by just introducing new stuff. And one of the other things that he found was that it doesn't matter if you evoke the schema before the new material or after the new material. It's a sloppy process. And those proteins are floating around just waiting to implant something in long-term memory. And so if you learned it before you evoked the schema, well, there's enough of those proteins hanging around to suck it in if it's relevant. And if you learn the new thing after the schema has been evoked, the same thing happens. Well, what do we do with that? Yeah, what do we do with that? Hold on, I forgot. I need to look back here for a minute. Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, this is fun. Richard Bandler. You all heard him.
Think so.
Okay. Loops. Okay? He said, I want to tell you this story about when I fought off 20,000 crazed motorcyclers who were all high on cocaine and they couldn't come and touch me. But wait a minute. First, I need you to think about something. You have this schema. You already know about stories. You know about the possibility of violence and the character, the characteristics of coke-crazed bikers. Guess what? The schema arises. The proteins start to cook. And what he tells you for the next 15 or 20 minutes gets sucked into your expectation for a story. Okay? And so even if it doesn't fit into the motorcycle story, it fits into your expectation for a story and becomes more likely that you will remember that than you would otherwise. John Overdurf. Did any of the Overdurfians show up here? Okay, yes. One of us, one gooble gobble goo. Oh, no. So John does this thing where he's going and he goes, right? He says, let me tell you about, what's that do? Here's a set of patterns. Here's a pattern where you have an expectation. You go zoop, and you're like, John, do it. Finish the damn behavior. What's the matter with you? But what's happened? He's evoked that motor program in you, and your expectation that something more is happening. Beyond that, there's that novelty piece that makes everything delicious. Okay? Well, what happens? Plugs in the information he wants you to have, and it sticks. Why? He's opened a schema, an expectation, and those neuroproteins are cooking, and they make available the kind of molecular structure that allows that memory to be turned almost instantly into a long-term memory. All right? Very powerful sets of ideas. Now, well, let me just backtrack a little bit. Common neuroscience tells us that it takes from 30 days to a year for a memory to consolidate. All right, most emotional memories can consolidate in as little as 24 hours, but, all right, other memories might take 30 years. The common wisdom was 30 days, I'm sorry. The common wisdom was you do something for 30 days and it's yours. Okay, so here's a folk rendition of that. It isn't completely accurate because there are all kinds of ranges. But what R.G.M. Morris has shown, and other people say et al., have shown, is that if you evoke a pre-existing structure, the chemicals start to cook, and those chemicals become available to make something instantaneously memorable. Okay? So that's an important thing. Think about memory palaces. I don't know. I mentioned Dame Edith Yates briefly before. And the ancient art of mnemotechnics was usually... Isn't that a nice mnemotechnics? Looks like a little fish making things. But really, it's the art of memory, okay? It's the art of memory. And the classic story is Simonides of Crete. He was a Cretan, but he did better than most. And in 300 BC, he was at a temple in Crete and speaking. He was a poet. He was famous as a poet. And he was up there on the dais, and he gives his presentation, and he sees where the people are. He goes out of the temple. There's an earthquake. The earthquake squashes everybody flat, and they don't know what to do. They can't tell who belongs to what family, who they are, what's going on. Hey, Simonides, come back here, see if you can help us. And he looks to each table and remembers which family sat at each table. And as he remembers which family sat at each table, he remembers which member of each family sat at each table. And based on his description, they were able to properly bury whatever remains they could find. Now, this became the center of the art of Loki, the technique of Loki, not the Norse god trickster, but L-O-C-I places, okay? That is the heart of most memory techniques. And it can be used to instantly memorize unbelievable amounts of stuff. Now let's try something. I've got a list here. I've got a little list, and they'll none of them be missed. Name that song. No, never mind. The Mikado.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. There we go. All right. Now, don't write this down. All right.
Three little maid trap school army.
Oh no. Okay. Don't write this down. Dog, camel, Gibraltar, scuba diver, Big Ben, Golden Gate, giraffe, ice cream parlor, tuba, knife. Anybody read those back to me?
If I could hear it better, I
might. Oh, but that's cheating because I'd have to say it again and you'd have at least one round of practice. The odds of your being able to read that back to me on one round is pretty slim, isn't it? Okay, let's try something. And this is an example of how this kind of memory works and how it is that sometimes people can see one thing and it changes their life. Okay? Or one thing can set off a cascade of experiences that destroys them. Oh, no. Okay. Now, you all have a place that you've lived for a long time. Maybe it was your first home. Maybe it's where you live now. Maybe it was a school. Some place safe. No place where trauma happened. Thank you very much. Think of a safe place. And I'd like the place to have 10 rooms. That could include the basement, it could include even the outside. But I'd like you to imagine that place. So if I were to go to my childhood home, okay. There's the garage, there's the sun porch, there's the kitchen. There's the dining room, there's the playroom, there's the living room. There's the foyer, there's our bedroom, there's the bathroom, there's the hall, there's my parents' bedroom, their bathroom. You know, I'd go through it like that. Can you do that? Do it three times. Think of a place where you've lived and just go it three times in the same order, one room at a time. So that you just get the habit of going through it one room at a time. Stick your tongue out at me when you're done with that. Okay. Okay. Good. And if you're not doing it, I hate you. Okay? Is everybody able to do that? Anybody need a little more time? We okay? Okay, now, the art of memory requires that you make the memory image grotesque, funny, as obscene as possible, if possible, multicolored, and with sound and feeling, if you like. All right? So what I'd like you to do is store a picture of these of each of these articles, one in each room as you go through that house or that place. Okay? Notice I haven't memorized them. A dog. Put that in the first room. A camel. He shouldn't be doing that. The Rock of Gibraltar. The Rock of Gibraltar. A scuba diver. Big Ben in the next room. The Golden Gate Bridge in the next room. A giraffe in the next room. An ice cream sundae in the next room. A tuba in the next room. And a knife in the last room. Okay, go through that. Make sure that they're bizarre, obscene, multicolored, making proper noises, making proper movements. How many of them can you remember? Who can name them all or is willing to try? Yeah.
Okay. Dog, camel, the rock.
Yeah.
And scuba diver.
Uh-huh.
Big Ben.
Cheaters! All right. How many people are realizing that you have just memorized a good part of a list of 10 totally irrelevant objects? Okay? And you can get to it. How many? Don't come lie to me somewhere. Come on. Okay. Isn't that surprising? But here is what R.G.M. Morris is talking about with rats. But we knew about it 2,000 years ago from Simonides. And actually, the art of memory was part of every schoolboy's, and it was only schoolboys back then, lady repertoire up until the 16th century, when that devil Gutenberg invented the printing press, and all of this went to hell. Okay? But here's something. Think about how quickly something can be integrated, if you imagine it powerfully, okay? Obscenely, but deliciously. Oh no! So there is something important about the way memory works, and there was something here that I wanted to point. How you go to work currently in restaurants? Werther's. Well, I guess that's it for that piece. Okay. We okay with that? So every time you evoke a memory. All right? If it's a schema, a long-term schema, a pattern, you can plug things into it. So you're on the way home. Ah, that's what it was. You're on the way home. I don't want to go home. No. You're on the way home, and you see an accident. And you may not get the details, but you know where in that pathway it happened. And it may be emblazoned in your consciousness for quite some time. Everybody remembers not only what happened 9/11, but where they were and who they were with. I was watching out my back door, the back of my office. I had a guy coming in for an evaluation. I was giving him the SASE, a drug evaluation form. I saw the thing burning. I said, oh, that's interesting. Turned back and gave the guy the SASE, you know. And then when he left, I turned around and saw the second plane hit. But all of us remember little tiny details. Why? Here is an important memory, okay? Now, this isn't a schema in itself. It isn't a pattern of behavior that we've learned. But here is a flashbulb memory, something that impresses itself on our consciousness, something vitally important to us. And it spreads out the proteins And all the little details from around the event hook itself to us. The day John Kennedy was shot, I remember encountering a red-haired girl in the hall that I'd never seen before. I also remember that my biology teacher's wig went on sideways, which I thought was pretty interesting because she was bald as a bat. And that's something else. But where do we run into this in NLP? I have been a crusader against anchoring as a one-touch phenomenon. Use Pavlovian paradigms, please! Okay? Because for the most part, when the people out there in the scientific world hear about anchoring, they want us, they're thinking Pavlovian conditioning, and they're right. And sometimes a one-touch, mind if I touch you? Oh, can actually evoke the response that you want. But here are the conditions under which that happens. If the response, think back to reconsolidation, is reasonably connected to their gestalt around those feelings, to their habits around those feelings. So if Rich is in the habit of being comforted and made to feel strong by somebody touching him here, my touching him here will automatically slot into that pre-existing memory structure, and I can depend upon that as a powerful anchor. If, on the other hand, Rick thinks I'm nuts, and he doesn't have any such thing, I'd better do that 3 or 4 times, calibrate every time until I'm sure that I get the response, because I need a straight Pavlovian installation. Is that reasonably clear?
Yeah.
Okay, so if we're going to talk about one-shot learnings, we need to talk very specifically about the context and whether it is appropriate and meaningful in the subject. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Otherwise, it's not going to work. And so we just have to. And typically what we do, if it doesn't work the first time, we do it several times. And there's the Pavlovian paradigm. Unfortunately, we have a lot of people who expect that it's always going to be that one light touch. And we haven't properly communicated to them that they have to calibrate. And if the calibration isn't there, they need to repeat it until they get the response. Yes?
Well, unless it's novel enough, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, is that a novel enough? Yes, novel, or it fits. One or the other is really good. How are we doing time-wise?
Because you think of one-time learning, I remember I worked with a woman who had a cat allergy, and we did the process with her, and it seemed to work when we tested it, but when she's at the next class, it had come back somehow. So we took and did a kind of a transderivational search back. When she was like 3 years old, her big brother, who was 5, picked up the family cat and threw it on her. The cat didn't like it, and he scratched her.
Oh, gee.
And so there was this, it was tied in with betrayal and being scared of the cat, and the cat, of course, reacted that way. So she had a sort of a phobic, allergic response to that. But I'm thinking the novelty of that was a strong anchor the last time. She was like 40 when it, I met her.
Yeah, I believe that's right.
So I was thinking, you put in the novelty. If you'd done something weird enough with Rich, he would have probably...
Rich wouldn't mind. That's right. But yeah, and I think that's a good point. The other thing, of course, is we sometimes don't realize how often future pacing is crucial. If you think back to Pavlov and his work with the dogs, one day he had been working with the dogs, he went home for the weekend, and they repainted the labs. None of the responses were there. Just the change of color was enough to mean he needed to retrain the dogs. Now, they didn't need as extensive training as they did originally to install the behaviors. However, they did need retraining. And so we sometimes don't have the good sense to future pace the stuff, to send people home with homework, to make sure that it travels beyond the limits of where we've done it and how we've done it. And sometimes that happens, I think, even with the allergy cure. Okay, and other things. Wait, what time is it? How are we doing?
It's about 12 minutes to 3.
So I got 12 minutes? Oh, boy! I got 12. Oh, any questions first before I start on the next part? Because there are 4 pieces. You get 4 pieces. Okay. Huh?
What piece are we on?
We just went back to the consolidation of memories by association with long-term schemata. Actually, That's the good Latinate way. It's psychologists say schemas. We just went to two. We went 1, 3, 2. Now we're going to go 4.
Okay.
Can you say that back to me?
1.
Okay.
3, 2,
3. I'm sorry. Okay. Now, are we okay? Any questions?
No. Go for it.
Okay. The fourth thing I wanted to talk about, and this came up in researching addictions and PTSD, is something called the default mode network. About 15 years ago, a guy named Ray Shelley was studying fMRIs, magnetic resonance imagery, on people's brains as they thought about specific things or did specific things. And he said, you know, there's background information here that we're not capturing and that we're not accounting for. He said, so let's see what happens when people aren't doing anything. And so he had people sit quietly and look at a cross-shaped stimulus. God bless you, a cross-shaped stimulus in the MRI machine. And he found that when people were doing this, the places that we normally look at for attention, the frontal lobes and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, orbital frontal cortex, some of the motor circuits, fire up. Okay, and parts of the midbrain are on or off depending upon what's going on. But when people looked at this cross and attempted just not to do anything in particular, there was a whole line of neural structures right down the midline that lit up. And the less people did, the more they were in trance, other people found, the more they were just talking to themselves or daydreaming, the more this system lit up. And they came to call it the default mode network because it wasn't related. Did it break? Because it wasn't related, okay, to external activity. It was about inwardly focused activity. And the parts are the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which is where we evaluate behavior, where we choose what we want to do, what we don't want to do. The cingulate gyrus, another place of cortical control and inhibition, okay? The posterior cingulate, which is an integrative center. The medial temporal lobes, where we access memory, and the parietal cortices, the inferior parietal cortices, where we prepare motions, okay, and have sensory information processed. And they began to look at this, and one set of researchers, then they found that when people were talking to themselves about nothing in particular, when they were planning the future, when they went second position, when they were imagining being in someone else's shoes, this place lit up, okay? We talk about the mirror neurons, and the mirror neurons are really important about present time relationship, about being empathic, but second position happens in this imaginative center. When we imagine things, when we plan the future, when we go into deep trance, this midline structure begins to light up. It's where we plan, it's where we imagine what somebody else is feeling. Theory of mind is what is called in classical psychology. And that's what we understand as second position to a large extent. How do I know that they're going to do that? Olivia, the other day, talked about a cricketer. And this guy is at bat, and I don't know how they do it in cricket. And he's watching the pitcher. Okay? And he's not been very good. He's had a pretty bad batting average. And he sees the pitcher running, and in slow motion, he asks him, if he's running like that, what pitch must he be pitching? And on some level, he stepped into the other guy's body and got a sense of the inevitable trajectory of the ball. And from that time on, he integrated that into the structure. Oh, into the pre-existing structure of the way he understood how to play the ball. But that second position piece allowed him to become a much, much better cricketer. Okay? Default mode network. Okay? And so one of the important things that we have, especially in NLP, is the capacity for inducing altered states, for awakening people. And when you use cognitive tools, like submodality analysis, like trance induction, to awaken that area, you begin to get some amazing things happening. What happens with family violence? One of the things that, classical psychology is, saying is we've got to teach them empathy. And so tell them what you feel. Did you hear what they said about how they feel? Yeah, I heard that. They said they felt this, this, and this. Oh, good, you understand that. You've got empathy. Baloney. They're not walking in the other person's shoes. Mm-hmm. They haven't taught them minimally rapport, which would begin to awaken those directions, but they haven't put them in the place where they can step into the other person's perspective, second position. So what happens if you take someone who's on the edge of psychopathy? Maybe they're scoring 25 on the psychopathy index instead of 37, but they're still up there enough. And you put them in trance and have them do an identification with somebody else. What's that do for them? What happens if you just spend time in trance? You know, reading through Erickson's stuff over and over and over again, we all hear with the abstracts of Erickson about the wonderful techniques he used, about the tasking and about the wordplay and about matching and doing all kinds of great stuff. But we seem to gloss over the parts where he puts somebody in deep trance, gives the unconscious a task, and goes and does his taxes, all right, and leaves him sitting there. What's going on? Well, here's a place where imagination works. Here's a place where the capacity to understand what another person is really feeling works. All right, here's the place where we plan our capacity to take our experience from the past and build a reasonable future is computed here. Okay, and if you've ever noticed that you start in the middle of a boring task, you start talking to yourself, you go inside, the task goes away. Okay, you start just zoning out, dreaming about that vacation. Okay, and the world goes away. I start doing anything and the world goes away. It's just really kind of nice. But that's where creativity, the possibility for planning, the restructuring of consciousness comes from. Hypnosis is powerfully activates the default mode networks. It adds a couple other pieces, some frontal pieces, some temporal pieces for speech and language, okay? But still, primarily what's happening in hypnosis and meditation and spiritual experience is this is being evoked. My simple question about this is that are we using enough deep trance, all right, just for its own sake? Without direction, trusting that the unconscious is going to drive the individual to really meet those needs, to really fulfill the positive intent that conscious activity can't get them to. And I just like to challenge you to think more about the value of trance, especially when we understand that the center of trance, the default mode network, is where we learn to plan. How many of our people have an inability to plan efficiently? It's where we learn to stand in someone else's shoes. When we spend enough time in ourselves, deep inside ourselves, we learn other things. Lama Uzer was a Tibetan monk who was being tested by Rich Davidson's lab in Madison, Wisconsin. They wanted to know what happened in the brain when a practiced Tibetan monk was meditating. And they put this guy in the FRI machine. They're checking his brain out, and he's going into deep meditation. And they pull out a starter's pistol and shoot it off. Bam! Okay? They watch his brain, and the level of activity drops momentarily, comes back up to where it was, and continues. And most people, the whole thing would go, ah! The amygdala go, whoa, 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 whoa! Okay. And other parts of the brain go, whoa, 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 whoa! He goes, and he also seemed to have this incredible capacity for reading other people's states, telling whether people were lying, knowing what they were feeling without them saying anything. I said, Lama, how do you do this? He said, well, you know, I've been meditating for years. I've been meditating for years, and part of learning to meditate is how you hold your face. You control the depth of the state with how you hold your face. And after so many years of paying attention to how I hold my face, I look at somebody else's face, and I see things flash across them. And because I've been there, I know what they are. When Paul Ekman, who actually brought him to Rich Davidson's laboratory, began his study of emotions, he found that there's something like 400 different muscles in the face. And he found that in order to learn what they really meant and what the expressions meant, he had to make all those faces. And there were some faces he couldn't make because many of those muscles are involuntary, and so he took electrodes and shocked them so that he could get those muscles to do what he wanted. God, must be nuts. No, but the reality is that he developed that same kind of fine discrimination, where because his face had been in those places, because his faces had been in those places, he could pick up what was going on with other people. Jeffrey Dahmer, my favorite serial killer, one of my heroes, used to see things flash across people's faces. Normal people would have an expression. And because psychopaths are often disabled in certain interesting ways, he had no idea what that meant. And so he would go home, look in the mirror, and try on the expression until he knew what it felt like. Then he could use it to manipulate other people. When I was a kid, I used to do the same thing. That's why I love Jeffrey Dahmer. No. I would see if somebody would have a face. I would have no idea what's going on with him. And so I would change my face so it looked like theirs and hold it. And I would feel it wash over me. I'd say, oh, that's what that means. And so here's another level of that. This is more on the mirror neuron level, but it's also about appreciating what other people experience and how meditation and the default mode network hooks into that. Okay, so I think that's about enough. Any questions, any answers, any imprecations or anything else? Yes. Oh, you just give me the finger? Oh, that's okay. Oh, no, I don't know what that was. Yes.
So, anything interesting to say about the anterior cingulate?
Well, the anterior cingulate is really important for judging whether or not you are about to make a mistake and whether or not you have made a mistake. It's about orienting behavior and choosing the proper behavior to obtain your outcome. Okay? So, what happens, for instance, in drug addicts, that the function is lowered, along with other parts of the frontal lobes. So without that ability to evaluate behaviors, and this is more in terms of right and wrong. Have I done it right? Is the sequence correct? Okay, should I be doing it? They very often give in very quickly to an impulsive behavior because they can't judge it. The ventromedial prefrontal cortex does virtually the same thing, but on social bases, based on memories of things we've been taught and learned. And both of them work have direct connections to the amygdala, the medial part of the amygdala, and inhibit it. So when they're functioning right, they stop inappropriate affect. Okay? Both of them, again, feed directly into the nucleus accumbens, and that controls how we value different kinds of behaviors and stimuli. So if it's not functioning, you get very strange things in terms of what you're valuing and very different effects on your capacity to inhibit behavior. Does that help?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Whoop. Well, what time? Yes?
How quickly can the networks be switched?
Actually, that can happen incredibly fast. William Miller, one of the great addictions guys out in Arizona, did a study with Susan Cabeza de Vaca back in, must have been 10 or 15 years ago. Everything in my mind is 10 or 15 years ago, so you got to forgive me. And he put an ad in the paper, and he wanted to know people who had a sudden dramatic change in their life that they couldn't explain, especially if they'd been addicted to alcohol or drugs. And they got something like 6,000 responses, okay? And people came in, and there were two broad types. One was religious, the other was non-religious or non-spiritual. And they say they were walking down the road one day, something caught their eye, like sometimes they couldn't even tell what it was, their life turned inside out, and they were no longer drug abusers or alcoholics. They were no longer related to that in any fashion. When they talked about it from then on, they say they used to do it, but it's not a problem anymore. And that's one of how quickly it can change. It can be just that fast. You hear about revelations and inspirations, and this is exactly that kind of phenomenon. I mean, I was a dirty, druggy, hippie guy for a long time, and I walked into this crazy evangelist was following me around, and finally I gave in, and I'd say 10 minutes I'd stopped using drugs, when at that point anything that you put in my hand went in my nose, up my mouth, or down my throat. You know, so it's, you know, a change can happen very quickly. So I think that that's something we need to be aware of. But that is a switching of a pathway. It's like Philip K. Dick saying that here's this infinite number of alternate universes, and you can take one step to the right, and suddenly you're in a new universe.
So you're saying there's a catalyst that can initiate the change?
Yes, but very often we don't know what the catalyst is. And the key is, for every person, there is probably a specific catalyst. So one thing might be simply an altered state. I had a guy who was a mafia lawyer, okay, and he had a severe cocaine addiction, and needless to say, they dumped him like a hot potato. And he'd been through all the programs that we'd offered. They were about to put him in jail, but they didn't want to because he was a lawyer and he liked to sue people. And so they gave him to me. They always gave me the worst people. And he sat down in my office and I said,
"Birds
well, what's that?
Birds of a feather."
Yeah. He said, "What do you need to change?" Straight out of Richard Bandler. "What do you need for this to no longer be a problem?" He says, "Well, I know, I can't tell you." "Oh, thanks, pal." So we worked on that for about a month, and finally he told me. He said, "When I was a little boy, I wanted to be a priest. I was an older boy. And if I went back to church, this wouldn't be a problem." So, well, what prevents you from doing that? And what would happen if you did? Or, you know, began to mental model that. Another month or so goes by. Comes in the office, and I'm pushing him. I had him coming in 3 times a week because he was really a difficult case, or so they told me. After about a month, he came back. He said, "I was at confession last night, going to church, you know, this weekend." A couple weeks later, stopped using cocaine. He's been clean now for probably 13 years because I have people who are in contact with him. And here was a guy who was just couldn't do it. Okay? Think about who was Cary Grant. Cary Grant was a horrible alcoholic. He described himself as an intractable alcoholic. Over a period of 4 treatments with LSD, he stopped completely. Never looked back. So for different people, there are different triggers. In my program, we sought to provide ecstatic states that would outframe the addictive behavior, just really out there trance states. That were under their control. For some people, that was enough. For other people, we use those trance states to generate well-formed outcomes, okay, that were meaningful to them. And for those people, pursuing those outcomes, finally having a future, was what changed them. It didn't work for everybody. We only had 30% abstinence after a year. But that still ain't hay. So the reality is that there are triggers that move people into different circuits. How you find them is a whole different story.
Isn't that context related as well within the person?
Well, the internal context is exactly what we're talking about.
No, I meant in terms of this is not going to move them in every one of their issues, but only in the issue that's contextual.
Depends.
I remember changes that I made that were totally moving away from, and most of them are moving toward.
Neither of them was, none of these changes were moving away from. And when you think about change, you want to think about James Prochaska's strong principle of change. James Prochaska was the inventor of the stages of change model. Mm-hmm. Pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and change. Classic pattern, great model. However, James Prochaska says this. He says, one night, he was thinking about the change, and something went on in his head. And he went downstairs and checked through several thousand studies, and he found in most of those studies, fully 33% of the change from pre-contemplation to actually doing something was predicted by one thing. He didn't say it this way, but I'm going to say it this way. It was having a well-formed outcome that was more precious to them than the problem behavior. And that's a crucial thing to consider. If someone doesn't have a future that is deeply meaningful to them, change may not stick at all. If they have that, not only will they pursue that, and that change will generate through their lives, but that will also allow them to devalue the problem behavior. The
trick.
I'm sorry? An attitude of gratitude.
Gratitude.
Oh, yeah. Give them some tubes and some rat mommies and some other stuff and just have a good time. And but that's really an important thing. What is the essence of a person? The genesis of my drug program came out of Jungian theory and the idea that everybody has a calling. Everybody has a purpose in life. Everybody has a direction that will make their life juicy. How do you orient somebody to that? How do you help them to find it? That's the trigger you're talking about. And when people find that, their lives can flip. And that's what Milton Erickson called a whole life reframe. Okay? And if we're looking for generative change, that's one of the places we want to look. I think that does it for time, doesn't it? Are we over, under, sideways, down?
Over.
Well, what else is new? Okay, thank you very much. And here's the handout.